You're listening to Shared Security, a podcast that explores the trust you put in people and technology. Hosted by Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. We talk a lot about the importance of multi-factor authentication on this podcast, but why does multi-factor authentication have to be such a pain for users? Well, I have some good news for you. It doesn't. Beyond Identity is the most secure MFA on the market and the easiest to use. Beyond Identity ensures that every authentication is multi-factor by default, with only phishing-resistant factors to secure access from the start. To find out more about Beyond Identity, go to beyondidentity.com/podcast to get a free demo today. Welcome to episode 287 of the Shared Security Podcast, and joining me this week are the co-host powerhouse duo of Scott Wright and Kevin Johnson.
Powerhouse.
That's right. How you guys doing? Doing pretty good.
Finished up our all hands here at Secure Ideas, and I will acknowledge that having that many people all together at one time is just overwhelming to me.
Yeah. Do you have all your hands?
I do have all my hands, and that's important because yesterday we spent some time in my garage at home making pens and things like that. So
there was a chance
I would have ended that without all my hands.
Very nice. So before we get into this week's stories, there's some, first of all, I do want to say that since our last episode, we now have 4 official supporters of the podcast through our Patreon.
So
thank you to our new official supporters.
I'm assuming that our plan
is not to keep a counter every time we...
No. But I did have the goal of by end of August, we'd like to get 5 Patreon supporters. So we only need one more. So that could be you.
That
could be you listening right now. So,
and you will unlock the next episode or the next level.
Yeah. So visit sharedsecurity.net/supporter to become that next Patreon. Much appreciated. It's also been a big week of all kinds of news in the cybersec community, right? I know we've seen the passing of Kevin Mitnick.
Yes.
So that is, it's unfortunate. And no matter how you felt about Kevin, it's really sad to see that. And we, of course, wish his family nothing but the best. So
I would never wish pancreatic cancer on anybody. That's
horrible. Absolutely horrible. Absolutely.
And a very minor memory of him. I remember meeting him at a RSA 2001, which was the last RSA I went to, sadly. But it was on a cruise around San Francisco Bay, and he had just been released. So he was out doing his PR stuff. And
That must have been a long time ago.
2001. Yeah. 2001 is a long... It doesn't feel like a long time ago.
I know.
2001 is a long time ago.
It is a long time.
He was joking that he went up to Bruce Schneier's book stall and was trying to ask him, you know, can you have any books on hacking? I want to learn how to hack people. It was pretty funny.
And then we also... Kevin, I think you wanted to talk real quick about... Some comments.
It appears... that last week's episode, a rant of mine, which I don't know why somebody would think I ranted, but a rant of mine may have ruffled some feathers. I received a phone call, and I apologize. I really do. I feel horrible. I realized that I don't remember the person's name. They called me yesterday at lunch and wanted to talk to me. They are one of the people in communications with ISC Squared. And they had reviewed what I said about the board approved slate of candidates, and they felt, and I believe this is fair. That's why I'm saying it here. They felt that I was missing some information. Which, let's be blunt, I am 50 years old. There is very often times I am
lots of information you're missing.
Yeah, lots of information I'm missing. So, yes. And I had a conversation yesterday during lunch, I think the two main points, and I'm going to say this, and then say if I am saying this wrong, please feel free to email me at kevin@securityideas.com and correct what I'm saying. Because I would like to, I think it's important that if I'm ranting about something or whatever, that we get all the information. So the two key points is I took offense or am bothered by, and that is true, I am bothered by the term board approved, because it implied, and according to this person who I talked to yesterday, it implied more than that what I thought it implied is not what it meant. And that what he wanted to make clear was that the board did not handpick candidates, which I don't believe is what I said, because I don't believe that they handpicked candidates. That what they had done was they created a nomination committee. The nomination committee contained non-board members as well. And that is who picked it. And really, the board approved aspect is just like a checkbox, is how he described it, as in, yes, we approve this slate of candidates. So that's what ISC Squared told me yesterday. And then the second thing that he felt that I was missing is that the criteria. I said that the criteria they were holding people to was not as transparent as I felt it should be, that it wasn't out there. I felt like they hadn't released criteria, and he took exception to that, because according to what he said, the ISC Squared criteria was the job description, that the job mm-hmm. description was taken as the criteria. And so those are the two things I feel that I captured correctly, that he felt I was missing in my rant. So I wanted to, okay, I feel it's fair. Only reasonable yeah. to share
yeah.
the other side. And I do want to be very clear, and I told him this yesterday, I am impressed by ISC Squared that they would reach out to somebody as unimportant as I am.
well, the fact bluntly, that, I mean, this podcast, I'm just impressed that somebody cared enough from your rant to actually.
Yeah, that's what I say. Saying, I'm impressed cool, actually. That ISC Squared is like, they're taking that. I'm not, I almost said they're taking this serious. And I always make fun of that phrase when incident handling people say, oh, they're taking this incident, your security seriously. But let's be very clear. I'm not an important person. I am not a celebrity. I am not. Contrary to the number of people who have asked me to sign Kevin Mitnick's books, I am not a celebrity. And I'm very literally not that important. And that for them to feel that was important to get out there, I think is good. I'm happy to see that they're getting out.
I agree. That means they care if they've reached out to you. So,
or it means they're scrambling. But no. I like, to me, a membership organization is driven by their members, and it's important.
Absolutely.
Communication happens, right? So that's what I said to the gentleman yesterday.
Very cool. Well, thank you for providing that update.
Yeah, thanks for letting me.
Of course. So now let's get into first story of the week, which is, you know, I just love this headline of this article, which is Microsoft lost its keys and the government got hacked. So
what's the connection there?
Well, so Microsoft is still, I believe, investigating how China-backed hackers gained access to a lot of email inboxes, including those of several federal government agencies, using a stolen signing key, which was used to forge authentication tokens. So, and the latest apparently is that Microsoft still doesn't know how these attackers gained access to, it was an inactive Microsoft account consumer signing key, which was able to access Exchange Online and Azure AD accounts. Over two dozen organizations, including, like I mentioned, some of federal agencies. There's been already, I think, some memes going around of where's the logs, Microsoft? Because I believe that's always been a challenge with these cloud Microsoft services, right? Like, the logging is very difficult.
Not as good as we'd like it to be.
No, not as good. So what do you think of this?
I read the article. I read multiple other articles. I'm a little bothered by the headline on the one article from a Bleeding Computer, I believe, Bleeping? I don't know. Yeah. One of the two articles that you sent out, Bleeping Computer, Bleeping not Bleeding. Bleeping and Bleeding are two different things. So the Bleeping Computer article, I'm really bothered by there. They don't know. Because if you read into it a little bit further, Microsoft very clearly says, we know the root cause in their blog. Now, we can say they're lying if that's what they're saying. They say they know the root cause. And the root cause was their code had a bug in it. They accepted an invalid key, right? Bluntly, I don't care how that key got out.
But how did they get to that?
I don't care. No, see, that's my point is I don't care.
Attack vector.
Yeah. I don't agree. I don't think that's the attack vector that we care about. I think they're burying the – first off, they're making it sound worse than it is. Microsoft hasn't told us how they got the key, right? That doesn't mean they don't know. They may not know, but I feel that they don't know. And as a matter of fact, another article, I think it was from TechCrunch, actually calls that out and says they either don't know or they aren't telling us, right? And that's why I say is I don't care how they got access to the key. The other reason I don't care about how they got access to the key is it was an invalid key.
Right.
I will tell you right now that I treat invalid keys way less sensitively than valid keys. I think the bigger issue here is Microsoft has come out and said, we had a bug in our validation. Yeah. We have fixed said bug. But the fact that the bug made it all the way to production, that's significant.
Yeah. That, oh, yeah.
To me, that if we want to focus on something, let's not focus on this clickbaity, they don't know how they got it. Let's focus on, hey, there was a bug in a fundamental security control from Microsoft. That's massive. And I'm thrilled they fixed it. I'm thrilled that they figured this out. They've done all this other stuff. I just think the clickbaity headline from Bleeping Computer is, maybe I'll get a call from their communications director. But
that would be awesome.
Sorry, that was snide and rude.
This podcast is an action line. Yeah.
Again, I'm actually really happy and impressed that they called me. I'm making snide comments, not because of them, just because I think it's funny. And what is it? Burying the lead? The phrase?
Yeah.
I feel like that's burying the lead, right? The fundamental control had a bug. Because let's be very clear. If you're verifying signatures and keys, if you're not verifying them correctly, that's broken. That's 100%. The entire purpose of that key is to be validated.
A lot of that process has been broken for a long time, though, in terms of checking like revoked certificates and things like that, right?
But I would say that I would think Microsoft is checking a key they generated is a little bit different than us verifying SSL certificates, somebody else. You know what I mean? Like, I agree with you, Scott. The process, that is often a broken process.
And the number of people who accept, that this program does not have a valid signing key. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. No big deal. No big deal. Yeah. This is an interesting one, but I think the big deal there is the bug in their software that allowed an invalid key to generate valid authentication.
Yeah, within their own environment. Yeah. That's shameful. Yeah.
All right. Well, Scott, are you ready for our favorite segment of the week, which is Aware Much?
I'm going to make that a ringtone.
I need to make it a sample or something that I could just hit a button.
Yes, Tom. Welcome to another installment of Aware Much. Brought to you by ClickArmor, the gamified security awareness training platform that's more engaging and interactive than anything you've seen before, I guarantee it. So in this installment, we're going to examine a hoax that was done to demonstrate the powerful potential of AI voice cloning. And normally we don't think too much about, social influencers, we don't mention them at all on this program, really. But in this case, in case people think we are influencers, which maybe we're starting to be now with Kevin getting calls.
Apparently.
No.
Anyway, a well-known by many people, not us, social influencer named Mia Dio came up with an interesting use case for voice cloning that used her boyfriend's voice in an interesting way. She was trying to get information out of his best friend about whether the boyfriend was cheating or not. And she created a social video that showed her using the actual voice-trained recordings that impersonated her boyfriend. And then those questions were asked to her boyfriend's friend about what he did the night before when he was out, which is an interesting use case, as I would call it. It was pretty credible, the application of the technique. I mean, you can imagine how all this kind of could happen, but it was all made up. And it was really from her point of view to demonstrate, you know, how easy it might be to do this kind of thing. But it went viral, her post. And a lot of people, I think, found the process surprisingly easy. And they showed her a lot of support, thinking that it was actually real. And then I think shortly afterwards, she came clean after it was posted for a while. It got like 2.6 million posts or shares or whatever, right? And so is this kind of demonstration, do you guys think it's making the potential of AI for everyday applications more real to people?
I mean, I think it's an interesting way that she demonstrated this, because she obviously has a large follower base of people that, you know, she could easily, you know, show the dangers, right, of this, because this is actually a thing, right? Voice cloning, scammers are using this technology right now, and they're finding people's voices to masquerade and create scams off of them. In fact, there's been other articles I was reading about, you know, this is now a new way to go after the elderly again by finding a trusted family member, and then they get a phone call and it sounds just like a loved one or somebody that they trust in their family, and then the next thing you know, they're giving away their account details. So so I think the approach was interesting. I also, you know, think about these influencers, right? And what are their motives, right? Is this an actual awareness piece, or is this just another, you know, video to, you know, gain even more followers?
For sure. Right? The motives were opportunistic, obviously, but but it is an interesting demonstration, right? That could be done. That shows people how easy it could be to do. So I think the bottom line here is we have to start thinking about, you know, what are the use cases that, you know, where voice cloning and deep fakes could be used in a way that impacts your daily life, you know, in ways, you know, might be security related or privacy related or just, you know, just harm inducing. Anyway, that was our tip for today. And you have any thoughts, Kevin?
I have two questions. One, I want to point out that we are not in any way discussing the ethics of what she did, because that's a completely different conversation. And I think it's important to point that out. But two, am I the only person who thought that she must have picked the free version of some AI voice print thing because of how computeristic it sounded to me? Obviously,
you're right about that.
I watched the video and I played it a couple times, and my gut reaction, and my gut reaction was the entire thing was staged. And the reason I think the entire thing was staged is the conversation made no sense. And I will be blunt. It's been a very long time since any of my friends were in a position that they needed me to cover where they were that night. Right? Like we're all boring now or something, right? Mm-hmm, but it's been a very long time. I cannot imagine, even if I was okay with my friend cheating on their spouse, whatever, right? Like let's ignore all of that. I cannot imagine him saying, "Man, I can't remember anything," ignoring the computeristic, and me going, "Oh yeah, man, in front of everybody, you cheated on your girlfriend. That is awful." Seems staged. Mm-hmm. I will point out that no matter staged or not, everything you just said is accurate, right? We're seeing where financial services organizations are failing voice prints that they're using to vet customers. We're seeing where elderly and not elderly are being scammed because of this software. Absolutely, those are important. So my issue with her potentially staging this thing and the ethics of everything she did is does not undermine the idea that this is an attack vector that is actively being used today. Not the, did you cheat on me, but the empty the bank account, transfer money. Hey, grandma, I'm in jail. Yeah. Can you bail me out? Like, those things are real and are happening.
Yeah.
And that's bad.
Totally. But I also think that no matter how, you sort of listen to it and say, well, this was, you know, clearly fake. The technology is accelerating all the time, and it's going to be realistic very soon. Right?
Well, no, Scott. There I'm going to have to say I disagree with you. The technology is already realistic.
Yeah, today. Yeah. Sorry, you're right.
She just happened to, it seemed like she picked the ad supported version.
What I should have said was,
$4.
The free version of that stuff is going to get better.
Yeah. She said she spent $4.
Oh, yeah. Anyway.
Sorry.
So, yeah. So, this version of Aware Much has been brought to you by ClickArmor, the gamified security awareness training platform. And we just hosted our 24th biweekly cybersecurity awareness forum last week on role-based security training, which highlighted how general awareness training is, you know, often only useful for reminding people to be careful or how vulnerable they might be. But when it comes to their jobs, what are they supposed to actually do? So with ClickArmor's approach, we can define roles like application developers or IT administrators and even executives and give them more meaningful tips on how to approach their jobs more securely. So if your team is not getting good engagement with your security awareness program or it's not effective, then take a moment to check out clickarmor.ca and see how easily we can help make a difference, not only with compliance, but with proficiency and security culture. So that's it for this installment of Aware Much.
Well, maybe Kevin's going to get a phone call from Mia Dio, the TikTok influencer,
maybe.
About his comments. So we'll find out.
Let's be clear. I don't want a phone call from Mia Dio. I don't know. Don't. Okay. If you're listening, Mia Dio, that just feels weird to say. Don't call me.
All right. So moving on to our last story of the week, which is the Biden-Harris administration has introduced a cybersecurity certification labeling program called the U.S. Cyber Trust Mark. So consumers can now choose safer and more secure smart devices. So first time I read this, I think trust mark. Is that like the mark of the devil or like what happened?
Oh, here? No, don't go there. You're gonna make me tell my book club joke.
No, I'm not.
So I have so many feels about this thing.
I have so many questions actually, but
Yeah. That's valid. I don't know that it sounds like a good idea. I think everybody who listens knows that I am not a huge fan of the government just going, hey, we'll do this. But I will also say that I do think there are benefits to some level of standard. I'm curious. I did not see any references to UL 2900 in this, which is something that I'm not sure has really taken off the way it should have, which is surprising to me with what UL is able to do with other things. You know what I mean? Like that, not saying it's good enough or whatever, but the fact that the federal government is pushing forward a labeling thing. They've talked about NIST, they've talked about FCC, they've talked about all these other groups, and they've not talked about UL. Yes, I'm aware that the UL is a private organization, but that hasn't stopped the government from leveraging that kind of stuff in the past. I've got a million questions. I will tell you that I've already tasked internal staff here to start looking into what this means and so that we can advise our customers, because we do a lot of stuff in the device, IoT, OT, manufacture all that kind of stuff. That felt like a sales pitch. That was not a sales pitch. We're already starting to look to see. We've been looking at it because they've talked about this before and everything else like that. But this, I don't know. I there are positives, there are negatives. I say ask me in 6 months. And right, like, set a task for the podcast in six months for us to discuss where this is at.
I think there's a couple of ways to look at it. One, I think Kevin immediately zeroes in on who's doing this, the government, and why are they doing it, and how are they doing it, and all that stuff. From my point of view, I think it's a good idea, because I think I'd like to be able to see in an Amazon store or something, this, you know, is certified to be providing security updates or things like that, right? I mean, that sort of certification, I think, could be useful to people.
Yeah.
Well, I would, that sounds interesting, but how many, what is it when the GMO free, right? Mm. Oh, this is not genetically modified. That's a title. But bananas aren't labeled as GMO, even though no banana we see in the produce department is what naturally grows, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
labeled organic, but yeah.
Yeah. Same type of thing, right? Like, the idea of a label. Okay, cool. I think that's awesome. But let me ask you a question. Which police force is going through the stores and Amazon to verify that the trust mark is being advertised correctly?
Well, let's put it this way. If UL was doing this, how would that apply?
That is a good question, but the UL is not a government.
True. Yeah. I'm not saying it has to be government. I said I was trying to separate the government part from the general idea.
But the issue with that, I agree with you. It's like doing that. But in this particular case, it is the government. It is government agencies. Okay. I'm curious what enforcement is going to look like. Because the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and I want to point that out only because one of the main points was they've registered a trademark, right? But the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office does not police trademarks. So the question is, who is enforcing? That's one of the biggest questions to me. And I say police force. I highly doubt the DC Metro is going to be going after people. But the FCC, the FTC, often police these types of regulations. I would expect to see this coming out of FTC, but I don't recall seeing the FTC mentioned. There has to be some level of policing for this. Policing is probably the wrong word. It's the right word grammatically, but not the right word implication wise. Right.
It's not so much a preventative thing as maybe a detection response, like a lot of laws.
But that's my point. If we don't prevent people from using it, right, then the mark will mean nothing.
Well, how do you prevent companies from creating, you know, unsafe power adapters and selling them with a UL label on them to store to, you know, as a supplier?
Again, UL is not a government agency.
It doesn't matter. I'm just saying
it does matter. That. And here's why. If I say to you that some random CPA is telling you you owe taxes, or if I say to you the tax agency is telling you you owe taxes, which one has the effect of fines and jail time?
Tax agency.
So a CPA saying, oh man, we're going to put out this thing that says your taxes are approved, means almost nothing if somebody abuses that. UL can sue, UL can ask agencies to help, but they can't enforce it. They have to leverage somebody else. The government can enforce. That's the whole point of government, right? And that's why I say is it really, really matters. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying I want to know how they plan on enforcing. Does that make sense?
I guess I'm trying to understand the subtleties. But if somebody other than the government, you know, created a coalition, you know, like kind of like the anti-phishing working group, right? They've got a bunch of major sponsors. They put together this program. They say, we're going to create this certification program and we will provide the certifications, we'll provide the testing, you know, all the economics of it, you know, is hidden or we can disregard. But if that program was offered, would that not provide value to people? And it would still have the same problem of enforcement, right?
No. I'm not saying it doesn't provide value. Okay. I think we're approaching this from two different directions. I'm not saying this doesn't provide value. I'm saying one of my main questions is, how is it being enforced? And the reason I ask that is, I know how UL enforces. UL enforces their trademark, their mark, the same way I enforce the trademark of professionally sure. evil. If yeah. I find somebody using it, I contact my lawyer and my lawyer emails them, right? That's how that works. The government doesn't have to have a go-between.
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
And
yeah.
so my question is not, is there value? Is there this? What I'm saying is, until we know how they're going to enforce it, I can't tell you whether having the mark on Amazon is going to matter to me. And the reason I say that is, how many times have we talked about in the past on this show, people putting stuff on Amazon that is fake, right?
Constantly.
And so it costs nothing for somebody to put an item on Amazon. And I'm picking on Amazon here just because of the reach they have, right? Yeah. It costs nothing for somebody to put something up and say it's trustmark certified on Amazon unless the government is actively enforcing the protection of that trademark, that mark. Right. So if they're not actively enforcing the mark, anybody can okay. say they did it.
Sure.
That's
sure.
my concern. I want understand. To know how they're going to enforce it. Once I know how they're going to enforce it, I'll tell you how much goodness we'll get out of it.
Yeah. Just real quick. My take is I'm really interested in the process that they're going to offer for certification. Right. Is it just a bunch yeah. of check boxes like you would in an audit? You just have to provide information that says a self-assessment type stuff, or is it actually does your device have to go through like a penetration test from a third party to validate certain, from a framework? Like they say they're using NIST guidelines, so I think that's good. I also saw in the list of organizations and manufacturers that are part of this. One of them is IOXT, if you're familiar with them. They are a standards body for security of smart devices. So they actually have a certification program. I know Bishop Fox is a member of that. So we are like a certified IOXT provider that certifies smart devices. And I'm sure there's other pen testing firms that do that too. So it is kind of interesting, and I'm curious to see how much testing they're going to yeah. want to do on these. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Hopefully Kevin doesn't get any more phone calls, and if he does, he'll be well prepared.
So, I'm never well prepared for calls.
Well, But thank you both, as always.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Much appreciated, and we will talk to you again for another episode next week. Thanks for listening or watching. If you like this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues and subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app. To catch all the latest from the podcast, visit us at sharedsecurity.net. Follow us on Mastodon at sharedsecurity, on Twitter at sharedsec, and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit.